The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Jennifer Weiner is the number one best-selling author of more than 14 books with more than 11 million copies in print. She returns today to continue the story of Alice Mayfair, her best friend Millie Maximus, and Jeremy Bigelow in The Little Foot, Big City, the second book in the Little Big Foot trilogy. Alice, Millie, and Jeremy race from the deep forests of upstate New York to the crowds and bustle of New York City, where they will confront their history, consider their choices, and learn what it means to be a hero and a true friend. Please welcome back Jennifer Weiner to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you all so much for coming, and I'm sorry I'm late. It turns out this is not the only thing happening in Center City today. Who knew? I'm delighted to be here, Andy. Thanks for the lovely introduction. Last year at this time, I was celebrating my Nana's 101st birthday in Michigan. And Nana asked me if I would do a reading at her assisted living facility. And I, of course, said yes. And I got there, and there's posters like all over the place. And what the posters say is, author Jennifer Weiner in like really, you know, fairly small typeface. And then in giant, huge letters, it says, granddaughter of Faye Fruman. Which I just thought was like the best thing ever. So I'm here with book two of the Littlest Bigfoot trilogy. Book three hasn't been written yet. Don't tell my publisher. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to read from the beginning of this book. I'm going to tell you how this book starts. And then I'm going to sort of take you through the anatomy of writing a middle grade book. You can't use curse words or have nudity. I've learned so much. It's like if there's nudity, it's YA. But if there's no nudity, it's middle grade. So there is no nudity in these books. Just hinted at. Hinted. All right, so this is how Little Bigfoot Big City begins. There were three judges on the next stage, the top-rated television competition in which singers and dancers, comedians and magicians, acrobats and ventriloquists all competed for a $1 million prize. At 9 o'clock on a Saturday night in New York City, the head judge, whose name was Benjamin Burton, was standing on stage. Benjamin Burton was 6.5 feet tall, with long legs and a thick head of glossy black hair. A mustache and neatly trimmed beard covered his face from lips to neck. Dark sunglasses concealed his eyes. There was something faintly menacing about his posture, about the way he moved, and even more the way he held still, with his head perfectly motionless, his body angled like a knife, posed like a wolf ready to spring at its prey. A girl who played the accordion and sang country songs stood to his left. A breakdancing boy was at his right. Above them were nets filled with barrels of silver and gold confetti, and in front of them was a crowd of 5,000 people, all of them breathlessly waiting for the winner's name to be announced. Devon, said Benjamin, indicating the little girl. Jaden, he said, and gave the boy's shoulder a squeeze. Both of you have performed brilliantly tonight, but only one of you can go on to the next stage. The girl looked up at him hopefully. The boy stared straight ahead like he was too terrified to move. Benjamin Burton waited, his body coiled and still, looking at the audience, examining each face, like a man looking for lost treasure, like he had all the time in the world. The judge who sat to Benjamin's right at the table that faced the stage was a singer, dancer, actress named Julia Sharp, who was famous for her glamorous good looks and long, honey-highlighted brown hair. On Benjamin's left was Romy Montez, a laconic country singer who was rarely seen without his Western boots and cowboy hat. The two of them had worked with Benjamin Burton for 3 years, but neither one of them could claim to know him or call him a friend. Benjamin appeared to be in his 30s, although no one was sure. When reporters asked where he'd grown up, he'd tell them here, there, and everywhere with a smile that showed his teeth. He'd never appeared with a date on the red carpet or waved to a special someone in the audience. He kept an apartment in New York and a house on the edge of a cliff high in the Hollywood Hills. At night, when the show was done taping, he'd go home alone, lock the door behind him, and stay there until he was needed at the set or on the road. Every afternoon, in every city, the next stage held auditions. Benjamin would prowl the waiting hopefuls with a clipboard in his hand. As he moved swiftly down the crowd, slipping onto escalators or cutting through the crush of bodies jammed into hotel conference rooms, his gaze would touch on every face. He paced and scribbled and stared, sometimes for so long he'd make someone uncomfortable, but he seemed to be able to sense the instant when his presence would become noticeable, and he'd move on, sometimes walking so swiftly that puzzled mothers would end up staring at the space where he'd been, then wonder if he'd been there at all. That was a section I had to rewrite because my editor said, "It's creepy to have a grown-up staring at little kids. Please, please don't do that." Oops. "He's looking for his lost love," was how Julia explained Benjamin's ritual. Julia was a great reader of romance novels, and she loved the idea of a cool, distant, polite Benjamin Burton having a lost love somewhere and searching the crowd for some woman who'd broken his heart long ago. Romy did not agree, even though he'd nod and smile when Julia unfurled her theories. He'd seen the set of Benjamin's jaw, the way he stood with his shoulders rolled back and his hands curled into fists at his sides. He kept quiet when Julia talked, but Romy didn't think that Benjamin Burton was looking for lost love at all. He thought that his fellow judge was, instead, scanning the crowd in every city they visited for someone who'd hurt him, who'd stolen something he'd treasured, someone who'd done him wrong. And when Benjamin Burton found that person, Romy Montez knew for sure that he didn't want to be anywhere near what happened next. So, dun dun dun. Do any kids have any idea what TV show I might be talking about in real life? Do you know TV shows where like people compete and they sing and they dance and they contort themselves into various shapes? Yes. Yes. You up front, right there. Yell it out. Yell out something. Dancing with the Stars, yes. Or America's Got Talent, or American Idol. There's lots and lots of shows where even little kids sort of perform and do things. So I was thinking about a show like that. So, Benjamin Burton is actually not one of the main characters in the first two books. He does become quite important at the very end of book two, but he's not a major player thus far. So, of the kids out there, who loves to read? Raise your hand if you love to read. Do any of you want to grow up and be writers? Do any of you ever think, yes! I have an aspiring writer in the front row. Okay, so this is kind of the story of becoming a writer with special emphasis on children's books. Okay, so that's the cover of Little Bigfoot Big City. And that's me. It was the bicentennial thing. So I was six. And I loved to read, too. And that picture was my first grade class picture, and my teacher's name was Mrs. Palin. No relation. And Mrs. Palin used to let me stay inside instead of going out for recess, where the other kids would tease me and stuff me in lockers and stuff like that. And she'd give me big stacks of blank paper, and I would write stories. And I remember I wrote one story about a balloon that like floated across the country and everything it saw. And I would read and I would write. And Mrs. Palin would say, you know, you're kind of good at this. You should keep going. You should keep doing it. So the most important part about being a writer is being a reader. So I read books like A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. Any of you guys read that yet? Yes. It's like so good. So good. And A Wrinkle in Time, which they're turning into a movie right now. And The Phantom Toll Booth. And I loved stories about kids going on adventures. Kids who would, you know, end up in some strange place and they'd save the world or they'd save their family and they'd come home like Max in Where the Wild Things Are and their supper would still be warm. So when I decided to write a book for children, I wanted it to be like one of my favorites. And I started to think about, okay, what do you need to do this? A blank page and another blank page. Wait, no, characters. Okay, so that's the first thing you need. You need some people to be doing some stuff, right? Okay? You need conflict. You need something to happen, because you can't just have these characters show up and be like, la, 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 everything's perfect, la, 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 everyone loves me. It doesn't work like that. You gotta have trouble, right? And the characters have to want something, which is usually part of the conflict. They want something that they don't have yet. So characters, conflict, and a world to put these people in. So I started to think to myself, if I'm going to write a book for children, who's going to be the star of the show? And my daughter Phoebe, who is somewhere in this audience, there you are, that's Phoebe right there. Phoebe was my inspiration, because Phoebe fell in love, there she is, posed on the couch in a frequent posture of hers. Phoebe fell in love with a TV show called Phoebe's Finding Bigfoot. She was obsessed with this show. I feel like every time I would stick my head into the TV room when she was allowed to watch her, you know, 30 minutes a day of TV, wink, wink, her 15 minutes a day of carefully supervised, only educational TV, it would be this show. I mean, that's educational-ish, right? So I would say, hey, Phoebe, did they find Bigfoot yet? And Phoebe would say, no. And I would say, I don't think they're going to find Bigfoot. You know why? And Phoebe would say, and I would say, because there's still 6 episodes left in this season. They find Bigfoot now, it's over. But I started to think about Bigfoot, as one does. And I started to think about, what are Bigfoots like? Like, what are some of the words that come to mind when you, as a kid or as an adult, think of Bigfoot? Just shout out some words. What do you guys think? Big. There it is. That was just luck. Who's got another word? Clever. Because, you know, they've stayed hidden all this time to the great, you know, angst of tabloid magazines. All right. Strong. What did you say? Soft. Does that guy look soft? I don't know. Do you think he conditions his fur in the wild? But I do have hairy, so that was close. All right. And dangerous, maybe. And afraid, because when they see people, they run, right? And shy. All right. So I started to think about, what did I want my Bigfoot to be like if I was inventing this world and inventing these people? And I started to think about not a big Bigfoot, but a little Bigfoot. And not a Bigfoot who was shy and afraid of people, but a Bigfoot who, much like Ariel in The Little Mermaid, wants nothing more than to be Phoebe.
Part of that world.
Part of that world. Very nice. You even sang it. I'm super impressed. All right, so this is a little bit I'm going to read about Millie. On a warm September night, a girl named Millie Maximus, wearing her favorite blue dress, climbed to the sturdiest branch of the lookout tree and hid herself in its shadows. It was late. The rest of the littlies were tucked up in bed, but Millie was too excited to fall asleep, even if she'd wanted to. From her hiding place, she watched as her father, Maximus, stretched out his arm, poking the tip of a long branch into the fire. Once the branch caught, the meeting would begin, and whoever held the stick could speak. "We all know what's happened," Maximus began in his quiet rumble as the speaking stick flared above his head. "The Nofers have built 12 new buildings, and this morning there was a welcome new learners sign hanging from two trees." So the Nofers, by the way, are what the Bigfoots call humans. We're the Nofers because we have no fur. "A school," whispered Aelia. "A school means children. Children are curious. They will be having canoes or those yak boats." "Kayaks," thought Millie and rolled her eyes. "They'll dare each other to come across the lake, or they'll hear us or see us, and they'll find us." Aelia began twisting her hands in her apron. Millie, meanwhile, was so giddy with delight, it was all she could do from dancing on her branch. A school! Maybe there would be no fur girls her age. Maybe someday she could find some sort of disguise or even a potion to make her fur disappear. She'd figure it out, and she'd make her way across the lake in a canoe or a kayak. She'd pretend to be a lost camper who'd wandered away from her parents, and she'd meet a girl and make up a friend, and the girl would hear Millie sing and say, "You are totally amazing." Amazing was the highest praise a Yare could get. The Bigfoot called themselves the Yare. And take Millie to the principal, who would know a producer as opposed to an amateur one, and then Millie would be where she'd always wanted to be, standing on a stage in a shimmery, silvery dress, holding a microphone, singing, while people listened to her, entranced. So that's Millie. So what words would you guys use to describe Millie? Yep. What do you think? Just shout out a word.
Tiny.
Let's see. Oh, winner. All right, what else? Yep. What do you think?
Curious.
Well, we got shy, determined, talented. Oh, no curious, but I think you're right. I think Millie is curious. And she's talented. She loves to sing, and she has a beautiful voice. And she knows about this television show. And she wants to be on this show, and she wants to win. And one of the things that I had to think about would be, like, do you think Bigfoots would watch TV? Like, would they have cable, do you think? And would they be online, and would they have, like, Amazon Prime delivery? And, like, how would they do it? So, you know, like, would they have an Etsy shop where they, like, sold stuff they made in the forest that was organic? I decided they would. So there's Millie. So we've got our character, and we've got sort of her, the thing that she wants and doesn't have, which is she wants to be famous and she wants to be a star. Okay, so then next we have Alice. And I figured if we're going to have a Bigfoot girl, we should probably have a human girl. And in every book I write, critics have noted, there's a character who kind of resembles me. A little bit, tiny little bit. So I'm going to read to you about Alice, who is my human girl. Alice had started her education at the Atwater School on New York City's Upper East Side, where her mother had gone. At Atwater, the girls wore blue and white plaid jumpers, white shirts, blue knee socks, and brown shoes, and they sat in spindly antique wooden chairs in small, high-ceilinged classrooms with polished hardwood floors. In her first week of kindergarten at the Atwater School, Alice broke two chairs, tore three uniforms, and wandered away from her class during a trip to the American Museum of Natural History. "Perhaps she's more of a hands-on learner," said Miss Merriweather, the educational consultant her parents hired after that disaster. So first grade was at the Barton Academy in a downtown New York City neighborhood, where the classrooms were painted bright colors and full of bean bags and pets, where the kids had recess three times a day and learned to knit and cook in addition to read and write. Alice distinctly remembered the squish and the squeal when she sat on the class guinea pig. The following week, she accidentally freed the class turtle, and the week after that, she impaled her teacher on a knitting needle. A different language, Miss Merriweather suggested brightly. By then, Felicia, Alice's mother, had worry lines in the skin at the corner of her eyes, and her father had gray strands at the temples of his black hair. Third grade was in Brooklyn at an alternative school for gifted students. Fourth grade was boarding school. Fifth grade, alternative learning center. By the start of seventh grade, Alice had attended six different schools and had failed to make a single friend at any one of them. At home, Alice would lie on her bed and try to figure out what it was about her that other kids didn't like. She knew she looked different, but that couldn't be the entire answer. Alice wore the same kinds of clothes, even the same uniform as the rest of the girls. She arranged the mane, which is her wild curly hair, as best she could to imitate their hairstyles and feigned interest in the books and the boy bands that they liked, forcing herself to sit still and listen to their chatter, even when her body ached to move. Still, there was something about her that made them reject her almost as soon as they'd met her. Alice had examined every bit of herself, from her toenails to the top of her head, trying to pinpoint the difference between herself and other girls. She'd never been able to find it, but she knew that it was there. She knew every time a new group of girls looked at her, and then, sometimes before she'd even said hello, they'd turn away, giggling and whispering. So poor Alice, right? What are some words that you guys would use to describe poor Alice? Yep, just yell. What do you got? How about awkward? Big?
Different.
Clumsy? Mm-hmm. Different. Outsider? Right. Yep, there it is. So we've got a little Bigfoot who wants to be human. We've got a human who just wants a friend, okay? And into this mix, we are going to add a boy, okay? Something else I learned about writing for middle grade is that girls will read books with boy lead characters, but boys sometimes will shy away from the notion of a girl at the center of the story. So I threw in a boy, okay? So I'm gonna read about Jeremy, who is the last of our three leads. Who's next? Miss March sounded bored as she peered over her classroom from behind her old-fashioned cat-eye glasses. Jeremy Bigelow thrust his hand into the air. The entire seventh grade groaned. Miss March's glasses flashed as she glared at them. Let's give Jeremy the respect he gave each of you, Jeremy. She waited while Jeremy, dressed in jeans and his favorite I Want to Believe t-shirt, made his way to the front of the classroom with a remote control clicker in his hands. May I have the lights off, please, he said. Miss March nodded at Lucy Jones, whose desk was closest to the switch. Some teachers let kids sit in a semicircle or even on beanbags on the floor, not Miss March, who kept the desks in neat rows with the troublemakers right up front. Lucy made a face at Jeremy and flicked the room into darkness, allowing Jeremy's opening slide, red letters on a black background, to come into focus on the whiteboard. Bigfoots, they walk among us, the letters read. The groans got louder. This is the exact same report he gave last year, Lucy shouted. Jeremy quickly clicked his remote and the words, "Now with exciting new research and evidence," appeared as a subtitle. Before anyone could complain, Jeremy began. As some of you may remember, yeah, from when you gave this report last spring, whispered Olivia Nunez to her best friend, Sophie Clematis. Jeremy ignored them. The myth of the Bigfoot has persisted throughout time and across cultures, with sightings, illustrations, photographs, and even films contributing to the growing belief that the Bigfoot, or Sasquatch, as Native Americans called them, are not merely folklore or legend, but are actual beings whose existence is a closely guarded secret. In the back row, Austin Riley made an armpit fart. When I started writing for children, I knew very little, but I knew there were going to be armpit farts. So I remembered that much from my own school days. Jeremy continued. When Europeans first arrived in the New World, evidence suggests that in addition to finding Native American encampments, they also found villages of Bigfoots. Aisling Tolliver raised her hand. "Excuse me, but shouldn't that be Big Feet?" She looked hopefully at Miss March, who sometimes gave extra credit during reports. But the teacher appeared to be cleaning her glasses. "Let's move along to the new evidence you mentioned," she said. Jeremy clicked to the next slide, a woodcut of a pilgrim village where a man in knee socks and knickers and a hat with a curled brim appeared to be trading a sack of marbles for a machete. The creature holding the machete was tall and bearded and broad-shouldered and apparently naked except for a thick coat of fur. "This woodcut," he said, "which I found after extensive research in the archives of the Standish Historical Society, is thought to depict a scene from the village that became our town. For all we know, we could be attending classes on the bones of the Bigfoots." He paused, letting his words echo, which they did, until Austin Armpit farted again. Olivia was braiding Sophie's hair, and in the front row, Hayden Morgenthau was resting his melon-shaped head on his forearms and snoring softly. Jeremy showed his classmates pictures of footprints with rulers set beside them, proof that they hadn't been made by bears. He clicked through newspaper reports of campers who'd been awakened by strange noises and seen gigantic hairy creatures running away, upright on two legs. He lingered on a newspaper clipping with a picture of Milford Carruthers, a Standish resident identified in the caption as famed Bigfoot hunter. And the worst slide, the one that always made him feel sick to his stomach, came next. "Behold Lucille, the famed and original bearded lady," blared a poster nailed to the wall above a cringing, fur-covered, human-sized creature in a cage. "Is she human? Is she beast? Born with a full head of hair, her beard was apparent at birth, and now she is covered with a pelt of thick fur. Experts consider her one of the wonders of the modern age," the old poster read. "My Nana's got a mustache," volunteered Lucy Jones. "Maybe she's a Bigfoot." Jeremy, who thought Lucy had a bit of a mustache herself, hurried through the rest of the slides, eager to get away from the image of the furred but unmistakably female Bigfoot cowering behind the bars of her cage. If he found a Bigfoot, he'd make sure it was treated better than that, not locked up or shown off for money. He'd be kind, he'd figure out its language and make sure it had a comfortable place to live with lots of space. He'd never keep a Bigfoot locked up. At least he'd only lock one up until he figured out how to make it understand that he was its friend. So that's Jeremy. So what are some words about Jeremy? Frustrated. What else do we think? Yes, yell it out. Kind, yes. He's. Let's see if we get kind. He's determined, overlooked, right? Are the other kids in the class being real nice to him? No, they are not. Okay. Kind of an afterthought. He's also the youngest in his family, and he's got these two older brothers who are like superstars. One of them's a really good athlete. One of them's really smart. Eager to please. Okay, so now we have our three characters. Now that we have our people, and we have to come up with some conflict, some stuff. All right, so there's conflict, more conflict. There's Jeremy thinking about Bigfoots. All right, so here's, this is the map of where the people are in this story. And before I thought about conflict, I had to sort of build the world that these people were going to live in. So I'm going to show you where everybody is. Let's see. A lot of times when you're writing fiction, you will find yourself drawing from your own life experiences. And I was very lucky because my daughter Lucy, who's not here today, attended world building. Phoebe, what does Lucy call that? Hippie Jew camp, yes, thank you. Behold, I think she actually calls it Hippie Jewish farm camp, am I right? Okay, so it's on a farm, and it's Jewish, and it is indeed hippie-ish, and when you drive up the driveway, there are people in face paint banging drums, holding garbage cans saying, "Leave your bad thoughts here." And we were driving up, and Lucy's like, let me out of this car. And I'm like, nope, you're going. So Hippie Jewish Farm Camp became the experimental center for love and learning, which you'll see. It's kind of, can you guys see experimental center over there? Okay, so the experimental center for love and learning, where we don't tolerate intolerance, is their motto. And they they think very carefully about pronouns and about representation and how people get along. All right, so there's the new school. That's the one that Maximus was talking about when he was talking to the rest of the tribe. There's the Yair village, okay? That's Millie's lookout tree. You can see it over there. And they're kind of in the middle. That's Standish Town. That's where Jeremy lives, okay? So now we've got our people. And like I said, I had to think about how the Bigfoots were going to exist in the world, and where would they live, what would they do for money, how would they interact with humanity? So lots of questions to answer, and I sort of imagined they would live kind of like, that's the Swiss Family Robinson village for people who are my age and can remember, but I sort of imagined it being like this Rube Goldberg kind of thing where, like, if you heard people coming, you would just pull a couple ropes and the entire thing would get hidden. You know, it would just disappear. So I sort of created a world like that. And, you know, there's Jeremy's world. It's sort of a standard classroom. And that's sort of how I imagined Alice and Millie seeing each other for the first time. If you're a Bigfoot kid, when do you think would be the only time it would be safe for you to go out in the world? And I'll give you a hint. It's happening really soon. When would it be? When could little Bigfoots go out? Anybody want to guess? Halloween, right, exactly. Everybody thinks they're Ewoks. So Millie runs away from home. Has anybody ever run away from home? Anybody ever been so angry that you like just like packed your bags and let, right? Okay, so what happened? Tell me what happened. So more than running away, you kind of like, you ran your parents in. I like that. So Millie wants to see the finale of this show and her parents won't let her. And she gets so frustrated that she decides she's gonna swim across the lake to where the school is and find a television set. Sadly, Millie is not a very strong swimmer. So she gets about halfway across the lake and realizes that like it's too far to go back, it's too far to get to the other side, and she's like splashing around and she's worried she's drowning. And Alice pulls her out of the water. And Millie has been told her whole life, like, avoid humans. Stay away from them. Don't let them see you. Don't let them touch you. Don't let them catch you. And if they do, you're supposed to give them one line. Do you remember what the line was, Phoebes? I don't know if you do. It's, I have a skin condition. So Millie, while Alice is sort of coughing up all of the lake water she swallowed, Millie runs and hides in the bushes so that Alice can't really see her. And she explains that she was swimming in her dress and the dress has gotten kind of see-through and she doesn't want Alice to see her. And Alice, who's never really felt great about how she looks either, completely understands this. And so Millie hides in the bushes and Alice sits on the sand and they talk. And Millie has all of these questions, and she wants to know everything about the human world. But every time Alice asks her a question, she gets something just a little bit wrong. Like, Alice says, were you camping? And Millie says, oh, yes, I was camping in the tent and the bag of sleep. And Alice says, sleeping bag? And she says, yeah, sleeping bag, that's right. And she says, my parents, Ross and Rachel, were there, and they were taking really good care of me, but then their monkey, Marcel, ran away, and I was chasing the monkey, because the only TV show she's seen is Friends, other than The Next Stage. So Alice and Millie become friends, and they go trick-or-treating together, and they're having this wonderful friendship, which for Alice is so special because it's the first friend she's ever had in her entire life, except Jeremy is trying to hunt down the Bigfoots. He wants to capture one and show the world that they're real so that he can okay, well, let me back up. Okay, so Millie wants to be famous. She wants to go to New York City. She wants to see the skyscrapers. She wants to win the show, okay? Jeremy wants to expose a Bigfoot. He wants to find out what makes them different from humans, and he wants to be the star of a ticker tape parade. And Alice just wants a friend. That's all that she wants. And so at the end of The Littlest Bigfoot, Alice and Millie are fast friends, except through some actions of Jeremy's, Alice discovers that she's not entirely human, okay? So in Little Bigfoot, Big City, Alice just wants to find out who she really is, and Millie just wants to win this singing contest, and Jeremy just wants to finally, once and for all, show that Bigfoots are real and be famous and more important than his brothers. So what happens? You will have to read the book to find out. And now I would love to take your questions if anybody wants to know anything about writing for children, writing for grown-ups, Bigfoots, you know, other creatures. Yes, right? How long does it take to write a book? About a year, which is like a really long time. Unless you're like Stephen King, in which or Joyce Carol Oates, who I think has like written a book in the time I've been standing here. So, but it takes about a year. And I write in my closet. I have this like really giant closet for it was I think designed for someone who has a lot more clothes than I do. So it's now my office. So yes, another question.
When will you be reading a telephone book for us?
A telephone book.
I also wanted to ask you, you are one of my favorite authors.
Oh, thank you.
I love the fact that you don't write the same story every time you write a book.
Thank you.
I don't believe that.
Thank you.
And when will you be writing a science fiction novel?
Well, you know, I'm working on a book that's set in the future, and I thought that it was sort of science fiction dystopia. And then Trump got elected, and all of this stuff that I'd been imagining as sort of can't happen here, kind of Handmaid's Tale, like no way that's ever gonna happen, has now happened, or is in the process of, I don't wanna get too political, but someday I'm gonna write science fiction, but right now I'm working on this sort of 10 years in the future and things have gone wrong. But I really appreciate you saying that about not writing the same book over and over and over, because that's like the last thing I'd ever want to do. I always want to be challenging myself. I always want to be looking for new stories to tell and new ways to tell them. And so thank you. I appreciate that.
Do you use a storyboard or do you just sort of sit
like
there
a whiteboard kind
of? And plot out your characters?
Hey. You know, I use notebooks. Like, I'm really old school, and I'm not very good at technology. I'm still using, like, Microsoft Word, which, like, Phoebe, what do you think of Microsoft Word? What do you use? Google Docs, which I don't understand. Like, I have this new editor, and she's very young, and she's like, do you want my edits, like, on paper or on track changes on the document? And I'm like, please not track changes, because I always mess it up, and I always, like, do the wrong thing, and I'm not very advanced. You know, I was, like, hanging in there for a while, like, I can text, and, you know, I love Facebook, I love Twitter. I do not love Instagram because it's pictures and not words, but I did it because my publisher said I had to. But now there's Snapchat and I just don't get it. So, but I'm trying. But no, I don't use storyboards. I outline things in a notebook. And then go back. Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
I enjoy your work. I really
Thank
like
you.
Your books. Can you talk a little bit about getting started when you have a book out there? Obviously I'm thinking about myself, so if you could talk about that.
How to start? Like writing your first book?
No. Getting it out there with an agent or a publishing house.
Ah, okay. Well, again, I'm very old. And I'm so old that when I was doing this, there was no internet. Okay, imagine, just close your eyes and go back to the world. Some of you weren't even born yet, but there was no internet. And if you wanted to find an agent, you had to go to the library and get this book called A Writer's Guide to Literary Agents. And you had to, like, what I did was I went through my bookshelves and I picked out all my favorite books and I wrote down who the agent was, because the agents are always thanked in the acknowledgments. And I made a list of agents, and then I went through this book and found out which ones weren't dead. And then, true story, and then I wrote a query letter. And I worked a long time on my query letter, because your query letter is kind of your one shot to get that agent to nibble. And agents, as you can imagine, are, especially now that there's email, they're just inundated with query letters and people saying, I wrote a book, please read it. I wrote a book, be my agent. You know, I wrote a book, I need help. So the first thing you have to do if you're writing fiction, you have to finish the book. I know, it sucks, but you have to finish the book. And then you write a letter, and my query letter, I can still remember it, lo these many years later. You know, I said, this is who I am, and I work at the Philadelphia Inquirer, and I went to Princeton, la-di-da, and I studied with Toni Morrison and Joyce Carol Oates, and I've published short stories in Red Book in 17, and I wrote a novel about a girl and her dysfunctional family and her unhappy love life and her happy ending. And would you be interested in reading it? And I sent that letter to 25 agents, and I got 24 rejections. Just like boom, 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 boom. No, no, not taking new fiction, not taking new women's fiction, not taking new popular fiction. You know, and the one agent I had who sort of said, yes, I will read this book, turned out not to be the right fit. So how I found my agent was someone who worked in the not right fit agent's office, freelanced for this other agent. So I, when it was clear that it was not working out with the first agent, I called this woman up and I said, I don't want to put you in a bad position, but I don't think it's going to work with me and your boss. And do you know any other agents with free time and low standards? So that's how I found my agent. And I think that now it's easier because you can just like Google people to find out if they're dead or not. God, I wish there was Google back then. And, you know, target your search. Like, find books that are like yours or relate to yours. When you're writing to agents, say, the reason I am writing to you is you represented Melissa Banks, A Girl's Guide to Fishing and Hunting, or Helen Fielding's Bridget Jones Diary, and I think my book sort of fits in with books like that. You know, agents don't like it if they feel that they're getting like a, you know, dear blank. You know, you have to sort of know who they are, what they do. And it's a numbers game. I mean, the famous story is the woman who wrote The Help got rejected, I think, from 200 different agents and like every publisher in town before somebody finally agreed to publish it. And, you know, every writer has that kind of rejection story, and every editor has a story of the book that got away. Like, my editor passed on The Lovely Bones. She's just like, this is depressing. Who wants to read about a teenager in heaven? You know, and it turned out the answer was everybody. You know, but like, everyone has that. You know, the one that got away. Like, I'm assuming I'm some agent's one that got away. And she's like, you know, I was just like, who wants to read about a fat girl and a movie star who falls in love with her? And the answer was lots of people, but they didn't know that. So, you know, ha. But I'm sorry. I don't like to gloat. but I actually did hear through the grapevine that first agent who we ended up not working together because she was giving me a very hard time about the size of the heroine and the improbability of somebody that size being a plausible romantic lead. And when the book sold, I heard that she turned purple and said, well, Simon and Schuster must be desperate. So... yeah, but you know, I think just it's, you gotta have a really thick skin. So just be prepared for people to say no, and remember they said no to me, they said no to Catherine Stockett, someone said no to The Lovely Bones, everybody gets it, and you will get it too, but persist And if you go to my website, which is jenniferweiner.com, because I'm really creative, there's like 20 pages of advice for writers, like how to write, how to find an agent, all that good stuff. So good luck to you.
I probably related too much to it, just tremendous. I noticed on my Facebook feed your tour, your upcoming tour, or maybe you're in it, if you could, something with the JCC, which I didn't see what that was, but if you could maybe share a little bit how the tour's going.
This is the first stop. So far the tour's going great. The tour's awesome! It's so funny. I'm doing my first school visit tomorrow. And what I learned is that when your schedule says school visit, it doesn't mean classroom. It means the whole school. And you've got to like entertain them all and like God help you if they get bored, because they will turn on you like that. Like what I've learned is that like if adults are bored or not entertained, like they will sit there and be polite about it. Kids will not sit there and be polite about it. Kids will squirm and like roll their eyes and start scratching places they shouldn't be scratching and like, you know, just not want to be there, very obviously not want to be there. So I'm visiting a school tomorrow morning, and then I'm at the Cherry Hill JCC tomorrow night, and then Tuesday I'm off because it's Halloween, yay, and then Wednesday I have another school visit in the morning, and I'm at the Wilmington, Delaware JCC that night. And then Thursday, it's another school visit, and then the Washington, D.C. JCC. And everyone's welcome at JCCs. You don't have to be Jewish. It helps, but you don't have to be. but the reason I wanted to do some readings at the JCCs were these were three places that had had bomb threats when that was happening this winter and spring. And, you know, these were places where they were evacuating the preschools and, like, you know, my mom's JCC was evacuated in the middle of her swimming laps. So she got, like, pulled out of the swimming pool and had to, like, wrap herself in one of those, like, I just ran a marathon silver blankets. And, you know, she sent me a picture of herself and I'm just like, this is awful. And, you know, like, what's going on and why is it taking the president so long to condemn it? So when I planned the tour, I sort of figured, like, I would like to be at these places and see if I can't bring them some joy. Or, you know, they can laugh with me, they can laugh at me, it's all good. So that's why the JCC is, and everyone is welcome. And again, if you go to jenniferweiner.com, you will see my entire tour schedule with, like, times and dates and where you should be and what time. I said time already. who wants to ask something? Did you have a question? No, you did.
Yes, well, she does.
She does. Cool. Yes. Even better. No offense.
No, I meant it.
All right, what do you got?
When is your third book coming out?
Oh, my God.
Remember your
just give me a minute here. When is my third book coming out? I don't know. I have to write it. And I have to finish the grown-up book first, according to that editor. It's a real pain. My hope is next fall. It was, the first one came out last fall, this one's coming out this fall, and then God willing, the next one will come out the next fall. And I will wrap up the whole story and tell everything that happens with all of these people and why the Bigfoots are so in demand and why there are adults who are interested in this quest and all that good stuff. So next fall, thank you for asking. I appreciate that.
Into a movie?
Are there plans to turn the trilogy into a movie? The film rights have been optioned. What that means is you take the money and you cash the check really quickly and then try not to think about it. Because, like, you just never know. The interesting thing is that my brother is a film producer and he's attached to produce this. But he's also working on the live action Mulan right now. So I think that's like taken a little bit of priority over me. Mulan has. But yeah, and you know, when I sold the film rights, I don't want to say I was demanding, but I will say that I was a firm advocate for what I want these characters to look like. Like, Millie has fur, and I don't want her being played by, like, Selena Gomez with bedhead. Right? And, like, Alice is, like, a bigger girl, and I don't want that to change. I think that kids of all shapes and sizes and races and ethnicities need to see themselves in books and on the screen, because I think that if you think that you have a place on the page, you can see yourself having a place in the world. I really believe that. So, thanks.
Thank you.
So, yes, you know, God willing, it'll be a movie, but who knows? Like, you just never know. You never do. I mean, for a while, like, my first book, there was a lot of talk and enthusiasm about that, except, you know, in Good and Bad, the protagonist is plus size, so I'd be like, they're going to have to, like, staple the Olsen twins together and then staple Nicole Richie to them to get somebody the right size. And then, these are, like, true Hollywood stories. I had a producer say, well, maybe an actress will get pregnant and not lose the baby weight really quickly. And instead of being like, that's awful, I would be every night like, and please, Drew Barrymore and Tom Green, let the condom break, which is like awful, awful, awful. And I'm sorry, children. But, you know? So, you know, you just, one hopes, but I would like to believe that the world is changing in terms of representation and in terms of what's acceptable. And I look at a show like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, where at least the lead is not like this big. She's this big. But, you know, we're baby steps, baby steps. So, other questions, comments? Yes.
So I saw your cameo on the TV show Younger.
Yes, thank you.
What was that experience
like? It's Weiner!
Yeah. How did that come about? What was that like?
Here's what happened. My older daughter, Lucy, who's not here, is obsessed with Phoebe, Sutton Foster, Broadway in general, and Sutton Foster specifically. So Sutton Foster is the star of Younger, and the producer of Younger, Darren Star, is represented by my publicist. Okay, so my publicist is like Julia Roberts, Darren Star, me. I don't understand it, but there it is. So I called her up and I said, is there any way for Lucy's birthday she could come to the set and meet Sutton Foster? And that was like seriously all I wanted. But they, you know, because Younger is set in the world of publishing, they were like, well, if Jennifer Weiner's going to be here, we should like totally write her in. And I'm like, yeah, write me in. Totally. So... I thought it was funny because people always get my name wrong. And I always say, like, you know, Wiener, Weiner, either way you lose. It's just not good. But Sutton Foster was lovely. She was so nice to me, and she was so nice to Lucy, even more importantly. So it was like a really, really great experience. And I love that, like, every time it airs, like, somebody will, like, talk to me on Facebook or Twitter, but I saw you on Younger, and I'm like, I know. So yeah, it was cool. It was a good day. And then we saw Hamilton. Yeah, and that was like right before Hamilton became like Hamilton, you know, when you could still get tickets at the box office, right? And then I took Phoebe 3 months later because I'm like, this is so amazing and she has to see it too. And you could not get tickets at the box office anymore. So... but it was a good day, and they were really nice to me. All right, anyone else wanna know a thing? Yes.
What made you choose writing middle grade versus high school?
Okay, what made me choose writing middle grade versus high school? Well, people have been talking to me about writing young adult for a really long time, and my answer is always, well, I don't wanna do that because somebody already wrote a book called You Are So Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah. Which would have been my book. Like, that was it. That there it is. So I'm like, I can't do that. Can't do that. And then, you know, I would think about, like, picture books, like, for little kids. But it's like, I'm not messing with Jamie Lee Curtis. Like, I am not, like, stepping on her lawn because, like, I hear she's really fierce. So, I mean, I didn't know this was going to be middle grade. I wasn't really sure, like, how that all shook out. But when I submitted it, they were like, you know, this is where we see it. This is where we think it fits. And I feel like young adult these days, like, I think you could be much more fanciful in middle grade, and I feel like with young adult, it's like there has to be some reckoning with the world as we know it. And there is that in my books also, but I feel like in young adult, it's much more like those are the books that are talking about racism, and those are the books that are talking about trans people, and those are the books that are really, they're kind of edgy. And I think that I'll do that someday. Like, I would like to do it someday after everybody's forgotten all about You Are So Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah. And I'll write a book called You Are Totally Not Invited to My Bat Mitzvah or something like that. But, you know, how it happened was I wrote the book first and then I submitted it and my editor was like, middle grade. And I was like, all right. And then I found out what middle grade was and learned all about it. But should we do one more question and then I'll sit here and sign your books and we can all go home to our various pumpkin fests? Because we're going to the South Street one. I bought a Trump wig, and I'm going to like do like a Trump pumpkin, a Trumpkin, as I've been calling. I'm not very artistic, but I think I can pull it off. All right, does anybody else want to know something? Does anyone want to ask Phoebe anything? Phoebe, do you want to take questions? Sure. All right, who's got something? Are you a writer? Okay, can I? I'll take this one. Okay. I mean, my joke is that I hope that neither of my daughters will become writers because I feel that an unhappy childhood is such an essential part of being a writer. Like, that's what drives you, is you sort of want to write these books where, like, the you character gets to come out on top and you get to, like, perfect the universe and, like, you know, give it to Amy Nelson, who was mean to you sophomore year in high school. That's not her real name. Yeah, it is. Totally. Amy Nelson. You can Google her. don't Google her. But no, like Phoebe loves to read, but like I would say that when you're writing, you're always like, how many more words is this till it's a page? Can I change the font? And I'm like, no, you know, because then the font like is like, bomb. And she's like, it's a page. I'm like, it's three sentences. So I would say you like to read more than you like to write. But I would say you enjoy stories. Like when Phoebe was little and she would be getting dressed in the morning, this is the last story I'll tell, but she would say, pick me out a dress. So I'd pick her out a dress. And then she would say, pick me out another dress. So I'd pick her out another dress. And then she would say, now make them fight. And so like the first dress would be like, I got stripes, you should wear me because I'm stripey. And then the other one would be like, well, I got polka dots and polka dots are better than stripes. And then they'd be like, aah! And the dresses would be fighting. And Phoebe would be like lying in bed, like laughing at the spectacle of the fighting dresses. Or like we'd go grocery shopping and we'd put groceries in the cart and she'd be like, make the English muffins talk. So I'd be like, hello, chicken. And she'd be like, no, Mom, they're English muffins. They have to sound English. And so I'd be like, hello, chicken, I'm an English muffin. You know, it'd be like Eliza Doolittle before she got refined, the English muffins. The English muffins would be like yelling at the kosher chicken, which was like Jewish and neurotic and was like, you know, does this plastic wrap make me look fat? And, you know, so anyhow. So Phoebe is a girl who enjoys a good story. And she's been the first people who heard the Littlest Bigfoot stories. So I'm very grateful to Phoebe and thank her for coming and thank you for coming and I will sign your books now or whatever you like.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at Free Library.